Good morning. May it please the court, Casey Granis on behalf of William France.
I meant to check. Which one of these cases is first, the PRP related to the jury convictions or the PRP related to the plea agreement?
First in time?
No, first on the calendar.
First on the calendar is actually the case that's second in time, which is kind of awkward to deal with. But so the case that's first on the calendar is the jury trial case.
Okay. So I just need to know. Okay. Would you like to reserve any time?
I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. So before the court today, we have a double jeopardy case, two of them, basically the same argument in both cases.
On the unit of prosecution.
On the unit of prosecution.
Although in the plea agreement case, we have the question of waiver, but I don't think we have that question here in the jury convictions.
That's correct.
There's no time bar.
Right. So good procedurally.
So, you're good to go. There's nothing to talk about procedurally in this case.
Yeah, let's get down to it. So...
So it's just unit of prosecution.
Yes, unit of prosecution in this jury trial case that we're talking about. And the unit of prosecution analysis exists as a protection against overzealous charging decisions. It exists as a check against prosecutors who want to arbitrarily divide up an ongoing course of conduct into separate units to increase the punishment out there.
And it's barred by double jeopardy. Most importantly.
Yes, most importantly. The double jeopardy analysis begins with, we look at legislative intent, we look at the statute involved, we interpret it. Happily, we do have a case to provide some guidance on this issue already, which is Division III's decision in Morales.
And you're relying on Morales.
Yes, as the basis.
There's no other case that addresses, that I'm aware of, and please tell me if I'm wrong, that addresses felony harassment and double jeopardy.
Correct. That's my understanding as well. We've got, well, in terms of unit of prosecution analysis, Morales is it.
So are there other cases that, there might be other cases where there was felony harassment in a different statute? I don't know. What other cases address felony harassment and double jeopardy?
None that I know of off the top of my head, Your Honor.
I mean, even setting aside unit of prosecution, I was unable to find any other cases addressing felony harassment and double jeopardy other than Morales.
And I can just say that I haven't looked into that avenue, whether the double jeopardy analysis had cropped up in other contexts aside from unit of prosecution.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, but... If Your Honor hasn't found it, I don't imagine I would have either. But turning to the unit of prosecution analysis that we have here, as I said, Morales is the launching point for Mr. France's argument. The court in Morales marched through its different reasons for why it found that the unit of prosecution for harassment was the course of threatening conduct, not each individual threat that was uttered. It looked at the legislative statement of intent, which encompasses multiple threats. It looked at the venue provision, again, encompassing multiple threats. It looked at the operative language of the harassment statute to knowingly threaten, not inherently a single act. And the Morales Court concluded that, you know, the focus of the harassment statute, the evil against which the harassment statute is geared toward protecting people against is placing the target of the threat in reasonable fear of being harmed. So we apply those factors to Mr. France's case. We've got a situation where, I mean, Mr. France is arguing, look, we've got three victims here. We're in the jury trial case. We've got two victims here.
All right, right.
Ms. Paulson and
Ms. Dugard.
So, I mean, Mr. France is not, swinging for the moon here. He's not asking for just one conviction, though.
Because you have two individuals. You have two individuals, so you're just asking for one conviction as to each of the two individuals.
That's correct.
So how do you address the language, the argument that the facts here are different than Morales, and the statement in Morales that we need not determine the unit of prosecution for all harassment scenarios because, you know, here it's specific to the same person, basically the same time, same place. It's what they talk right. about. So what's your response to the argument that this language as applied here would mean that we would reach a different result?
Well, the response is that you don't. The result's the same.
It's why?
We recognize that in Morales, yes, it was hedging its bets. It didn't want to make this blanket statement about unit of prosecution. But if we look at actual analysis, though, in terms of how it dealt with the facts in that case, when Morales is saying, okay, we're basically saying we're limiting our holding to the facts of this case, it's basically limiting it to the factual prong of the
right.
prosecution analysis.
Right. right, which is the question I was
right.
posing.
So, okay, so the point I'm laboriously
how do you meet the factual prong?
Okay, very good. So we look at, well, again, what do we look at in the factual prong? I mean, the case law is somewhat amorphous on this issue in terms of, I mean, I'm pointing to Hall as one of the examples that for guidance, the witness tampering case.
Right.
Where they found that the unit of prosecution for the witness tampering in Hall was that it was the course of the tampering conduct, not each individual phone call to the witness. And, you know, it found factually in that case that there was one unit of prosecution, but it also said, well, you know, if the means through which the tampering had changed or if there was a break in time due to, prosecution, I think it was, or something that
right.
Then, you know, maybe our analysis would be different. That's what Supreme Court in Hall said. So I apply those factors to Mr. France's case. They're not, and those circumstances aren't here either.
Well, don't we have a break in time?
Well, we do have a break in time between the first set of threats that form the basis of the plea case, and then about a year passes, and then we've got the second set of threats. That
well, but you're combining the sets. I mean, within those sets, don't we have a different dates?
We do have different dates, yes.
And so we have different times. But you want to combine those and say this is the same conduct, even though there's a temporal disconnect.
Yes, because there is somewhat of a I mean, they're not all on the same day, right? I mean,
right.
It's obvious. That's not, I'm arguing that's not dispositive, though, on the factual inquiry prong in the unit of prosecution.
Did you want to go into your rebuttal?
Yeah, I'll go into it a little bit. So, actually, you know what, Your Honor?
What?
I'll stop right there.
Okay.
And I'm going to pick up on the factual prong in my rebuttal. Thank you.
And, you know, with both cases, I think you all will have plenty of time to talk about this. Since you make the exact same argument in the plea agreement case.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington to respond in this case. The first thing I want to say is I sincerely apologize for last week. I can say that in over 20 years as a prosecutor doing trials and court of appeals, I have never screwed up and not shown up because I wrote the date on my calendar wrong. To make it even more ridiculous, as I was telling Mr. Grant, I even went to the court's docket to see what judges were on my panel and still didn't recognize that I'd written it down wrong, but I do apologize.
I think we've all had that dream.
What's that?
I think we've all had that dream where we wake up and say, do I have an argument today?
Yes, but have you all had that phone call? But to talk about these two cases.
No, just talk about them separately.
Well,
you think
I will, but
different.
I would say that the focus on both of them is the unit of prosecution first, because
right.
if the court rules in the state's favor in unit of prosecution, you never even have to get to can you attack the plea. I want to deal with a little bit of some of the arguments that were made in the defense reply brief, and because this is purely a question of legislative intent. And in Chapter 9A46, it includes the harassment statute, it includes the stalking statute, what also includes violation of an anti-harassment order statute. Now, we know from State v. Brown, Parmalee, and State v. Allen that each contact, each phone call, each letter are all separate chargeable events under violation of a court order. So Let's take the defendant's conduct in this case, and let's assume there was only just one victim, not multiple, just to make it easier. If there was no contact order in place, we know by case law, each one of the phone calls Mr. France made is a chargeable offense.
Now, there was a no contact order in place.
But that's not the way it was charged. It wasn't charged as a violation. We know that it's a chargeable offense. Now, the defense is saying if there's not, it's only one count, no matter what, one count. Now, how is it rational for the legislature to say in one case you can have literally an unlimited number of charges, and the other case you can have only one? There's got to be a rational reason for that.
Well, there was a mention of the no contact order. Was that in the way the plea agreement case was charged?
I don't recall off the top of my head, but I believe they talked about the no contact orders in terms of raising it to a felony level, if I recall.
That
not
could
in
be.
Terms of dealing with unit of prosecution or anything.
Oh, no, it was not in the context of unit. I just remember the charging document. So there's an information, it's an amended information, and it's attached to somebody's brief. So there's an amended information that you've provided for both the jury trial and for the plea agreement. And one or both mentioned the no contact order that was meant.
And I can't remember if both do as well. I know the second one did because there would have been a no contact order issued in the
after the jury trial. I think that's probably right.
Yeah, but there may have been an earlier one too. I just don't recall. Off the top of my head.
But that had to do with, as you said, elevating the charge to a felony.
Well, that's the way it was charged, as I recall.
Yeah.
But it would affect the unit of prosecution analysis as well. But my point is, why would the legislature, because the defendant's saying, you know, they wanted only one count. That's what the legislature intended in this situation. Well, why would you have this completely disparate punishments and way of charging under the same chapter? That doesn't make any rational sense for the legislature to do that.
Don't the unit of prosecution cases require that we start with the language of the statute? So you're saying you don't even get to that point if you look at which chapter it's in? Or what would be the test here for us in looking just at the language of the statute to say that this is consistent with the state's analysis?
Well, the ultimate goal is always trying to find out what the legislative intent is. Yes, the first thing you do is look at the language. Now, the language, as I've indicated, I don't believe supports the defendant's position.
But it doesn't say anything about unit of prosecution.
No, it doesn't. And the only statutes that I know of that do are when there's been a case that has dealt with it.
Hall.
Like Hall.
Yeah.
And I think Hall is important because I think the defendant misses the import of the Hall decision. And just, you know, it's witness tampering. It's not this statute. But the Court of Appeals, and Judge Schindler, I realized this morning you were on the Court of Appeals in Hall, said that each contact is a unit of prosecution. The Supreme Court then reversed that, and then the legislature immediately put in a provision that said each contact is a separate unit of prosecution. Now, the import of that is this, in my opinion, because the legislature also said, and this is a quote, in response to State v. Hall, the legislature intends to clarify. And then they went on to talk about the unit of prosecution. Now, why is that important? The defense is correct. That doesn't apply retroactively to witness tampering. But the import of that is the legislature telling the court, this is what we meant all along. The language in the witness tampering statute, essentially they're saying, you got it right in the Court of Appeals. That's because we're simply trying to clarify what we already intended. Now, Hall, the Supreme Court, didn't have anything like that in front of them. This court does. This court can now look at the witness tampering statute and say, yeah, the legislature told us this type of language, this is exactly what we meant. Each contact is a separate unit of prosecution.
Do we have any legislative history? Nobody's provided any.
I provided that quote. That's 2011.
No, I'm talking about for felony harassment.
No, I don't think there was anything. I know I looked at it one time. I don't recall anything that was enlightening in terms of unit of prosecution. Otherwise, I'm certain both sides would have provided if it helped either side. The second aspect of Hall that the defendant mischaracterizes is his he cites to Hall and he says, well, there's a different mode or manner of delivering the threat or the passage of time. It's a new unit of prosecution. And he cites to Hall. Well, that's incorrect because Hall said, we do not reach whether or when additional units of prosecution consistent with this opinion may be implicated if additional attempts to adduce are interrupted by a substantial period of time, employ new or different methods of communication. And the defendant has cited no case at all where those types of things have created a new unit of prosecution. And there's a good reason why. Because you can't create a unit of prosecution analysis out of thin air. It has to be based on the statute. And there's nothing in the witness tampering statute in Hall, there's nothing in this statute that says the passage of time, for example, creates a new unit of prosecution. And also, how would you even apply that? Now, in this case...
Well, in Morales, they applied it, and they came up with same time, place...
Well, there was a very... they limited it to a substantial degree. But what is that time? Is it a day? Is it a week? Is it a month? Is it a year? Is it 10 years? The reason that's so absurd is because you have to base it on the statute.
Well,
if the statute said something about passage of time...
You may say it's absurd, but we do have this Division III case, and I know you disagree with it.
I do.
But that is... that. The court, nobody petitioned for review. This is the law as it stands.
Well, it doesn't govern this court. I totally agree with the dissent in the opinion. All they were talking about was the same course of criminal conduct, not double jeopardy. And it was limited to the, even if you apply Morales, the defendant loses because that was same victim, the same threat, the same time, the same place.
So what's the difference here?
You don't have any of those things.
Well, you have the same victim.
You have the same victim. You have one out of four criteria. You've got different types of threats. You've got different timing of when those he's supposedly going to carry out those threats. He talks about having other people carry out the threat for him. He talks about it when he gets out. He talks about doing it in an elevator. He's going to do all these things to them. There's no threat for a specific time. The threats themselves are made at different times. You don't have anything except the same victim. That's it. So even under Morales, the defendant would lose.
So but course of conduct is not really a analytical category for the unit of prosecution cases.
That's correct. It's essentially a charging and a factual decision.
So it becomes a fact-based decision for each and every time it's charged. I'm just trying to figure out what our mandate is here, even under Morales.
I'm not quite sure I'm following you, but...
Well, if it's not a course of conduct, then you still look at certain factual components to determine whether it's a unit of prosecution.
Well, once...
Or at least Morales
Once you define the unit of prosecution, if you're under Morales, you do have to look at the facts. Again, I disagree with Morales. I don't think there's any support. There's not much of an analysis in Morales. I think it's contrary to all of these other statutes, the way they've divided up unit of prosecution. And boy, that time went fast. Thank you, Your Honors.
Well, anything you missed will come up in the next go round.
I promise I won't repeat myself.
I'll hold you to it.
I'll make good on my promise to turn to the factual prong of this analysis in this case. So what we've got, just to put a fine point on it here, we've got... In relation to Ms. Paulson as the victim, we've got three threats, November 11th, November 17th, and December 5th. So about a little more than 3 weeks, it's time span there. Then we've got Ms. Dugard, we've got two threats on November 10th, and then December 14th. So it's about 5 weeks or so as the time span. And
Are you taking the position the threats are the same?
Well, we've got on November 11th, they're the same character. That's my position. We've got, for Ms. Paulson, I mean, I went through each of these threats, which I had to do. And we've got, on November 11th, Ms. Paulson, we've got a vague threat of friends paying her a visit. November 17th, we've got a threat of friends taking her out. December 5th, we have a threat of rape and putting a bullet in her. With Ms. Dugard, November 10th, we've got a vague threat to get her. September 14th, we have a threat of rape. And all this is occurring within the context of what's happened before in relation to the earlier case involving the plea.
Oh, the plea. Mm-hmm.
In other words, the victims in this case are going to be necessarily, when hearing those type of threats, they're going to be considering the context from where they're coming from.
Well, as I was asking the state, if course of conduct is not a method of analysis here, and we can't tell from the legislative intent, we just look at each factual scenario?
Well, it's a two-step.
Determine if it's a unit of prosecution. I'm just trying to figure out what the test is, even under Morales.
I mean, here's my position. I mean, it's a two-step analysis. We know that. First, we look at legislative intent, and then we look at the facts of. That's the first step. Second step, we looked at the facts of a particular case to see, okay,
so
does it still
hold up?
What
do you think the legislative intent is of this statute?
That, as per Morales, the legislative intent is to criminalize the unit of prosecution is ongoing course, is the course of conduct for the threat. Course of threatening conduct, another way to say it. Not each individual threat that's uttered. Then we turn to the factual prong of the analysis, and we're looking at it in the context of this case. And the argument here is that when we look at how courts are treating, you know, whether on this factual point, they use the language of course of conduct. They use the language of continuing course of conduct. In fact, this court in Furseth tied the unit of prosecution to the unanimity context there, basically holding that, well, if it's there's no – basically saying if it's unit prosecution applies, then the course of conduct that's charged is continuous as a matter of law. That's the guide that I'm asking this court to look to and apply it to the facts of this case and find that it is continuous course of conduct on the facts. Thank you.
All right. And if you would just stay there.
Yeah.